The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good to see you all today. While we're celebrating this annual festival memorial on the anniversary of Reverend Master Jiyu's death, as you most of you know, she died on November 6, 1996. So we're pretty close. We always celebrate it on a Sunday, of course, and her entering into parinirvana. So it seems fitting today to offer some reflections on training with her and her teachings and some of my favorite teachings from her diary of her training in Japan, The Wild White Goose. But I'd like to start actually going back in time a little bit to Japan when Reverend Master Jiyu was the foreign guest master at Sojiji. Her master, Keido Chisan Koho Zenji, gave her the job of being a guest master to all the non-Japanese people who came to the temple at the time. And he was very keen on training, offering the Dharma to people from other countries and cultures. And so that was one of his, a very dear thing to him. And I just thought I'd read a little passage from him, because it shows you something of how dear that was to him and also of his kind and benevolent heart and teaching and of what was passed on to us through Reverend Master Jiyu. Now, Reverend Master Jiyu was helping the foreign guests at the Jukai Precepts Retreat, and they were given these little booklets which the monks have been given. They're little treasures. Mine is fading, but I still keep it. It's falling apart, but it has the translation of the Kyoju Kaimon, Dogen's commentary on the Kyoju Kaimon in it, and a little message from the chief abbot of Sojiji at the beginning. He says, "The universe is one and undivided, yet seeming different in all its appearances. You who read this book or hear this message are of a different race and language, unless you're Japanese American. You are of a different race and language to me, yet we are one with all beings in the Buddha mind. For just as the sweet dew covers the whole earth, so does truth reach to every corner of the universe and permeate every living thing. We welcome you to the fold of universal compassion, love, and wisdom that is the joyous realm of Buddha. He who takes the Kyoju Kaimon, the precepts, for his own or she, becomes the personification of the highest and greatest enlightenment, thus becoming a baby Buddha. Since you are the child of Buddha, be careful never to kill Buddha." That's his little message. Chisan Koho, chief abbot, he signed it. So I thought something very special about that for me, just the care and kindness and benevolence that comes through in his teaching. And so you can see those of us who trained with Reverend Master Jiyu experience that in her presence, in her person as well. And we're doing our best to continue that practice, that training, and offering it here. And you can see that there was strong emphasis, and always has been in our tradition, on following the Buddhist precepts as guides in our training. So along the lines of precepts, I thought I would look at a few reflections from Reverend Master Jiyu's diary, The Wild White Goose, diary she kept of her training in the Far East. She changed the names and some of the details so that because she didn't, you know, she wanted to, didn't want to have, you know, damage anybody's privacy, but the teaching comes through. And these are some of the little reflections, some of the stories that have particularly affected me in a profound way in my own training. If you've read The Wild White Goose, if you haven't, this is what it looks like. We have copies of it up at the guest house and also on our website. And you'll notice that she mentions in this final edition of The Wild White Goose that it's very important to read the introduction to it. And in that, she says that without that introduction, you could go wrong. She doesn't want to influence people to make mistakes and judge some of the things that happened to her. So that's a very important piece. And I've always been intrigued in reading this by her honesty, her very direct honesty. This was written some years after, of course, she was in Japan, and after she had her third Kensho experience, after considerable training and deeper understanding. And so she went through it very carefully and made comments on attitudes of mind and thinking that she felt was not appropriate for a Buddhist. So you'll see, and if you probably have already seen these comments, footnotes at the back that say, this is un-Buddhist thinking, or it's wrong of me to think in this way, or a Buddhist wouldn't have done that or said that. Or the statement that really intrigues me, this is un-Buddhist even if it's true. Now, that's a big one, and I think that really figures into precepts. And I think it's, for me, it's a really good turning point, a teaching to help one turn deeper in one's practice, because it's so easy to, especially if you're on the internet a lot, to allow your thinking to drift into judgment and into places where you perhaps didn't really intend it to go. And we're only human, so we tend to sort of go with what's popular. So it's a very helpful reflection. Many times throughout the book, you know, she's having difficulties. Here she is, the only woman and the only Westerner in an all-male Japanese temple. Mostly young men are being trained there. And her master wanted her there, but it was very difficult for her. And not too long after World War II, so there was still some difficulty, resentment regarding Japan losing the war and so on. But nonetheless, she really struggled to, she was successful in her training, but every so often, of course, she finds herself going into some negative thinking. So here she is, the foreign guest master, and Koho Zenji is offering, her master, the abbot, is offering a private guest room of his to her for the foreign guests. And because there isn't any place, she's having a very hard time to find a place for them to stay and bedding and so on in the temple. So he offers his private guest room to her because a friend of his is building another place for him in the temple. He figures he can give that up. But this wasn't a very popular idea with some of the officers of the temple. So she says in her diary here that as they're discussing this, the chief guest master glared at me but could not argue because the chief abbot wanted to do this. So she asks Zenji-sama, is how she refers to her master. What about the food, Zenji-sama? I asked. And Zenji-sama says, the kitchen will provide food for these guests. What about payment? Cried the chief guest master. Jiyu has already arranged that. They will pay the same as do all the Japanese guests who come here. And the chief guest master bowed, very well, Zenji-sama, and he swept out of the room. And Reverend Master thanks Zenji-sama and bows. And Zenji-sama says, it will be good to have my disciples in the room beside me, he said. I will be able to feel their closeness. Bring them to see me often. I want to see them at least once a day. And she says, yes, Zenji-sama. And then she says, I went away and made the necessary preparations for the guests to move into their new accommodation. I had an incredible amount of difficulty in getting beds to put in the room. Finally, however, after a lot of argument, I succeeded. It's truly amazing how much the foreigners are getting out of this particular jukai. When I went to bed tonight and I slept in the same room as they did, the feeling of joy and anticipation was so real, so wonderful, so different from the jaded feeling that one frequently gets from the Japanese. However, there's a little footnote. Guess what? No footnote. So this is, you know, her later, she's examining herself in light of later training. And there she says, okay, this is wrong thinking, even if true. Now, you know, most of us would think, well, that's very reasonable. I mean, sure, you know. But what is that little grumbly self in there? That's the thing to look at. Do we really need that? And I found it very, very helpful to examine some of her examples, and they lead me into my own thinking and feeling throughout the day to examine myself and realizing how often we feel we have to sort of add a little punch to the karma, you know? That we have to add something to it. It's not enough just to see it and notice it, okay, and we do our best with the situation. We have to add something, or perhaps just out of impulse, you know, and karmic habit, we add something. There's some strong feeling or thinking there. But you know, what she's telling us is we don't have to do that. And in, I know in my examinations of myself, I found this very, very valuable. She's not judging herself, by the way. She's just, Master Jisha pointed this out yesterday, she's just noticing that this is what she did. In the light of later training, this was not wise, and she doesn't want to do it again. But it makes such a difference if we just let go of that little extra bit. You know, the law of karma does a really good job all by itself. And we don't have to add to it. And if you look at things that way, and especially when you're looking at the news or commentaries, you can see how much we feel this need to, you know. But if we didn't do that, think of how much more likely we would be able to hear each other, get along with each other, or find resolutions to difficult things where we might disagree with others. So I suggest, you know, looking through this sometime at those examples. There are a number of them that are very helpful. We'll come to one or two others. Jumping to another story that has had a profound impact on my life at different times in my training. There's a little story early on in Reverend Master Jia's training as a novice monk at Sojiji, the monastery in Japan. And she had just had a conversation with her teacher. And forgive me, this, my voice is a little weak with after singing. And she's sort of, you know, very profound teaching, and she's wanting to sort of mull over it in her mind, right? And yet it's time to go to working meditation. So I'll read you the story. The bell went for the hour of working in the garden, and we all changed into work clothes and went out together. It has never ceased to amaze me how these old senior priests rush out to do hard work, whilst many of the juniors have to be almost forcibly dragged. Guess what? Footnote. Let's see, look at that one. Okay. Perfectly reasonable. No, is it? Well, what's going on there? This is non-Buddhist thinking, she says. Okay. So, okay, she may have noticed something, but did she have to give that oomph to it? No. Interesting. Anyway, she says, I wanted to think about the conversation we had just had, and being a bit annoyed with my fellow juniors who have done very little to be friendly in the past couple of months, I went off by myself to dig up weeds instead of joining the main body who were removing daisy roots in another part of the grounds. Oop, another footnote. Un-Buddhist behavior and speech. Now, this is where I have found this very helpful. This story has come to my mind on occasion, but you'll find out why. It's really saved my life on occasion. So she's going off. I was busy digging away when I suddenly discovered the chief disciplinarian digging beside me very quietly. And it seemed we were rapidly being joined by a large number of others who were digging in my daisy patch. Quite soon, I realized that they had formed a circle around me and were digging inwards towards the center where I was digging. Thinking that I had come to the wrong place and not wishing to cause problems, moreover, all I wanted to do right then was think, I moved off to another patch several hundred yards away. The circle converged on the center I had vacated. One set light to the pile of daisy roots and everyone dispersed. I went back to concentrating on what we had been talking about with her teacher previously. Then I noticed that Reverend Sansoburo and Reverend Hajime were quietly working on either side of me, both sides of me. Opposite, some 20 yards away, was the chief disciplinarian, and before I knew it, a huge circle was formed of which I was a part. Reverend Ichiro came up to the circle and somehow fitted himself in between Reverend Hajime and I. He busily cut away at the weeds and then whispered in my ear, "You should dig deeper." At first, I thought he was referring to the weeds, and then I knew that he was not. We all arrived at the center of the weed patch, more or less simultaneously, and someone thrust a box of matches into my hand. I lit the pile of weeds, and they left me to tend the fire, moving on to another patch. As soon as I had got it going, I left it and went off to another place, determined to think. But the circle formed around me again, and Reverend Hajime whispered in my ear, "Now is the time of digging up weeds, not thinking." "But I can think whilst I dig," I said. He produced pencil and paper. "Not if you dig properly," he wrote. "When you are digging weeds, you are digging weeds. When you are thinking, you are thinking. Right, not left, has many meanings." This is something they had been talking about. "Also, we train together, not alone, up mountain. When one is enlightened, all is enlightened. You're trying to cut enlightenment, but it cannot be divided. We are one circle, not two. No one is outside Buddhism." Again, a reference to Kōhō Zenji's teaching in the beginning. "Well, what if enlightenment wants to be cut from me?" I asked. "That is enlightenment's problem, not yours. Your problem is not to cut enlightenment. So I must train with others whether they want me or not," I said. "You are not their problem and they are not yours. That you train or not makes no difference to enlightenment, but it does make a difference to you. By training yourself with others, you train enlightenment, and enlightenment trains you. No one can do your training, and you cannot do theirs." The bell rang for the end of the period, and somehow I know what he was talking about, but how the heck does one put it into words? So there we go. I don't think I have to explain that very much, because we encounter that a lot in our training, and I find that story very helpful. There are, and it really shows the importance of why we refer to our work as working meditation. I also use the term resting meditation for myself, because sometimes I'm trying to do many other things other than just rest, and I'm not really ending up feeling very rested. You can apply that to everything you do. Eating meditation is very, very significant. So one aspect of it for me is that I've seen that our karma, you know, it kind of expresses itself in our thoughts and our feelings. And if we can't just put it down once in a while and let it be, not cut it off, but just let it be, we'll never really penetrate to the source of our existence. We tend to just float about on the surface of the skandhas, the feelings, the thoughts, the body. We float about on the surface, and that's, in my experience, what continues the wheel of rebirth, the wheel of dependent origination. But through the meditation, in this case the working meditation, we can penetrate below our thinking, below the stuff on the surface, and just do what needs to be done. And practice what Dogen talks about, dropping body and mind. It's not a cutting anything off, but it's a penetrating to who you really are, which doesn't, you know, stand against the thoughts, the feelings, but it doesn't allow us to be blown away by them, you know, to be carried by them. So there's a time for thinking. We do have times of reflection in the evening when we do reflect on the daily, our behavior, our training throughout the day. And we do that for a little while, maybe write in a diary, then we let that go, then we go to meditation. Very, very helpful practice. So, how to really transform our karmic impulses. And the teaching that she's trying to recall and figure out and understand while she's working, we have to have faith that that actually comes into our lives naturally without our having to think it through necessarily. The other thing about this is the fact that we don't train alone. And I know there was a time in my life when I was away from the Abbey and had to deal with some debts and other issues that were going on in my life. And I'd had some major changes. A lot of grief had come up. And I found myself in that kind of a state where I felt I was very, very involved in my thoughts and my feelings, put it that way. I didn't know it at the time. And we are, you know, when we experience loss and pain. However, I remember a certain time when I began to realize that that was what I was doing. And what really helped me was the simple practice of just do the dishes, just sweep the floor, just sit, you know, just relax. But also I became aware that I was isolating myself with that, trying to think it all, figure it all out in my mind. And I realized I had to come back to the Abbey. So jump into the middle of the fray, you know, wherever, you know, pain or no pain. And I'm very grateful I did. But this story was very influential to me in helping me to realize, oh, you know, you're always going outside the circle, trying to make sense of life, trying to make sense of your karma, trying to make sense of whatever it is. But actually, you can't. You have to be part of the whole. So, one of my favorite stories. And just a little addendum. You've read stories of great masters. Many of them have realized the truth, awakened to the truth in the midst of daily life activities. It doesn't always happen while you're listening to a Dharma talk. It might. Or when you're meeting with a master or in meditation, it can often happen when you're, you know, on the toilet or out in the garden or running like mad between three jobs, you know, because you're somebody's sick, you know, whatever. There are so many stories of masters realizing the truth, and trainees, any one of us, realizing the truth, having enlightenment experience in the middle of some ordinary daily life situation. I remember reading a little story when I was reading some Dharma talks by Master Su Yun, the well-known Chinese Chan master, where he talks about a monk who was likely to be a chief cook walking through a market in China in a city. And he must have been very ripe for enlightenment. But he walked past a butcher's shop. You know, the shops are all open at the front. And he happened to hear a conversation between a butcher and a customer. And the customer was complaining about something to do with the meat not being clean, something like that. And the butcher yelled out, What can you find here that's impure? And when the monk heard this, he was enlightened. Yeah. So there you go. No excuses. It can happen anytime, anywhere. I relate that story because I read that when I was at a hermitage once, and it really got me. I thought, oh my God, yes. What am I carrying around here? You know, our thoughts of impurity, impurity. Huh. So you never know where it's going to come from and when. So be prepared. And just do the practice. Finally, I wanted to just touch base with another aspect of Reverend Master's training and teaching from the Wild White Goose, and certainly something that was very much strengthened for her in her later years of training. because she did encounter a lot of difficulties, and she had choices of either becoming very miserable and falling into despair, or looking at things from a very different attitude of mind. So after some situation where she might have been thought she was being treated unfairly, she was having a conversation with one of her teachers, and some of you have read this before, and she says, "Well, the only thing I can possibly do in order to learn anything is to accept in blind faith that everything that is happening to me, believing that it is all for my good, whatever it may be. If I do anything else, then I shall always be saying that this person is good or that one is bad, or this situation was good and that one was useless, etc." I'm editing a little bit. She says, "I'm here to get beyond the opposites and I must stop discriminating." And this is a pretty big teaching and sometimes quite a tall order, it seems. How can I possibly do that? There's so much injustice in the world, or in my life, perhaps. Yeah. But I think it's very, very significant. And she does say in one of her footnotes in this diary later on that this sentence is probably the most important sentence in the book from the point of view of someone who wishes to learn Zen. So I'll just highlight that today. Adding to that, one of her teachers says, "Always you must believe that everyone has good heart for you. If you do not do so, you never become peaceful at all. Buddha must be seen in all things." I'm not there yet, but I'm working on it. And I must say, I long to be thus. But when I do turn in that direction, I find that it completely changes everything. It doesn't mean that we don't address things that are wrong, that there aren't injustices, that there aren't things that we need to do something about in our life and in our world. But the attitude of mind is so very different when we look at it through the eyes of Reverend Master Jiyu here. Yeah. It's an attitude of faith. It's very easy, and I think for myself, I have to watch this if I'm on the internet too much. And I don't blame the internet. It's just a tool, and it can be very useful. But if I am not careful, and also just the way my mind works, I can easily be carrying around despair, misery that I don't need to. But if I can truly sit still with something and accept it as being perhaps I can, make use of this for my training, then I find that I can go with a flow of benevolence, that there's always something there just waiting to help me. There's something actually always helping, regardless of whether I'm there or not. And we begin to see the bodhisattvas appearing everywhere. We begin to experience the Buddhas and ancestors helping us. So that is available to us at all times. It does require faith. It requires hard work. But as for Master Jiyu found out, and I'm finding out gradually, what else is there worth doing, really? So those are some of my favorite stories. As when I started to look at these, I found many other favorites, but I'm not going to keep you too long today. And just to complete this talk and underline this teaching that we've just heard, I'd like to just quote from Reverend Master Jiyu's Kyoju Kaimon commentary, her precepts commentary, where she talks about harmony as the Sangha treasure. She says, "This is brought about by the knowledge that no matter what a member of the Sangha may do, he or she is immaculate from the very beginning. There is nothing from the first to cling to, in other words, or to judge. Thus shall you think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a child's laugh, a phantasm, a dream." A quote from the Diamond Sutra. "Although this is true, the members of the Sangha, the Zen masters, all beings are bound by the law of karma. They will pay the price of what they do. Thus is the mind of the Sangha treasure." So we can let the law of karma do its work. We don't have to to some extent, perhaps not realizing it, play God and add to it. It does a good job. And we can see the compassion in it and allow it to help us. And truly, I think this applies not just to the Buddhist Sangha, but to all beings. If we can find the immaculacy at the heart and the intention at the heart of what someone is doing, we can see their good heart. We still have to address things skillfully, but we can begin to live in greater peace with ourselves and others by doing so. So there you have it. And in gratitude to Reverend Master this day. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.